With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The way that democracy usually dies is that popular support is used to justify mass coercion. That's what's happening now.
I'm Alice Denby, Deputy Editor of CapEx, and for my first episode of Free Exchange, I thought I should make life easy for myself by interviewing someone widely regarded as the smartest man in Britain. Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court judge, medieval historian and Reith lecturer, is also an eloquent and authoritative critic of the government's handling of the pandemic. Not only does he dispute the scientific evidence, he said the lockdown is legally and constitutionally unjustified. We spoke via Zoom as England was put back under a work-from-home order, and I started by asking him how he felt about Boris depriving him of his liberty for a second time.
So, Lord Sumption, thank you very much for joining me on Free Exchange, the CapEx podcast. So you've obviously, in your Cambridge University lecture and in many other media outlets, criticised both the ethics and the efficacy of the government's approach to the pandemic. You've warned about the death of freedom. You've spoken about a police state. So I was wondering how you feel about being back in lockdown today.
Well, it's not too bad for me because I have largely intellectual activities. I have a large house with a nice garden. And so, I don't suffer a great deal from lockdowns. I don't live alone. But for many other people, it's an extremely painful, disorienting, and lonely process, as well as, in many cases, unbelievably disruptive of their finances and of pretty well every other aspect of their life.
You've been particularly critical, I think, about the process by which the government's taken these measures, particularly the failure to consult Parliament. But on this occasion, the government has laid out its forecasts on which it's taken this decision. There was a vote in Parliament. These measures apparently enjoy popular support. Isn't that a proper process to follow in a democracy?
The latest example is a lot more satisfactory than the earlier one. My view is that the government does not have the power to do what it has done under the statute which it's used, namely the Public Health Act. It would have that power under the Civil Contingencies Act. What the government has done with the latest lockdown, but didn't do before, is first of all, it has laid its regulations before the House of Commons, before they come into force, instead of afterwards. The first lockdown was not put before Parliament until 7 weeks after it was came into effect. Secondly, it has given them a relatively short duration of 28 days. The Civil Contingencies Act requires any measures taken under that act to be resubmitted and reapproved every 30 days. So they have now started acting as if the Civil Contingencies Act applies, although that's not the statute that they've used. That's undoubtedly a considerable improvement. As to the popular support for this, I agree that there is popular support for it, although the weight of popular support has tended to decline. But I am not impressed by the suggestion that that is sufficient to make this a democratic process. The way that democracy usually dies is that popular support is used to justify mass coercion. That's what's happening now.
What about the data suggesting that the NHS is likely to be overwhelmed without serious action? The head of the NHS, Simon Stevens, said that we've got 22 hospitals worth of COVID patients, and that if we didn't take action, we'd see patients being turned away at the door of A&E, doctors having to decide who lives and dies.
I agree that if it's justified on the facts, that is a serious argument. I happen to think that the amount of damage it's done is so great that is not a sufficiently strong argument. But that I accept as a value judgment. However, before one accepts Stevens's assessment, I think one needs to see rather more data than the government is willing to produce at this stage. And the data that they produced at the press conference last Saturday contained a number of charts that are frankly manipulative and disgraceful. The criticisms made in the House of Commons by Theresa May of this exercise in the debate on Wednesday were entirely justified, and indeed even Chris Whitty has now accepted that the 4,000 a day estimate should not have been put forward. There are a variety of views about the likely future course of the disease. The government's decision is justified by reference to a modelling exercise of a kind which has consistently been shown to overstate the likely growth rate of the disease ever since March. It represents in many respects an abuse of the modelling process, because models are essentially based on assumptions. They provide a framework for decision making, but they are not forecasts and they are not evidence, as the authors of certainly the Imperial College models have frequently pointed out. The evidence which is produced by other reputable sources, notably the King's College London symptom tracking app run by Tim Spector and his team, suggests that the risk of an increase in infections and hospitalizations of anything like the level shown in the government's models is extremely unlikely.
Do you think, even if you were more convinced by the data, that you would still object to lockdown?
I would, but I would accept that is essentially a value judgment on my part, which is not susceptible to proof. It depends on, if you're going to compare oranges and Thursdays, you clearly need you clearly can't do it mathematically. I think that one of the problems is that the government has never produced anything resembling a risk assessment or a cost-benefit analysis. In July, a House of Commons committee, having heard evidence from ministers, criticised the fact that when the lockdown was originally imposed in March, nothing remotely like a cost-benefit analysis was carried out. That seems still to be the position. Certainly, one must assume that since the government wishes to persuade us that they are doing the right thing, if they had anything like a cost-benefit analysis, they would have told us what it said. The regulations have consistently contained a formulaic statement from Mr. Hancock to the effect that these measures are proportionate. Without a cost-benefit analysis or an impact assessment, I do not see how he can possibly know whether they are proportionate. What seems to be happening, this is certainly what one deduces from Chris Whitty's evidence in the relevant parliamentary committee a few days ago. What he said was that these are dangerous measures justified by the threat to public health. My understanding of the government's position is that it considers that there is no amount of social or economic damage that it is not worth putting up with to avoid a significant number of deaths. I do not accept that. It seems to me that deaths from significant epidemics have been a feature of human existence for millennia, that this particular epidemic, although serious, is not by any means the most serious that we have had to deal with over the years. And it seems to me that we have to accept that there will be deaths, not least because it is far from straightforward how one is in the long term going to avoid them. Lockdowns do not reduce deaths except while they're in force. When they are lifted, what happens is that the infections and associated deaths that you have avoided are simply deferred into a future period. Now, this is not controversial. It was a point made forcefully on two occasions before the first lockdown by the Imperial College modelling team itself. And it is indeed what we are experiencing now. We are experiencing the infections and deaths that were not prevented in the long term by the first lockdown.
I think what you're saying is that protecting our freedom is more important than preventing people from dying of this disease. Is that a fair characterization?
I wouldn't put it as absolutely as that, because I don't believe that freedom is an absolute value. I think it is a very high value, because I think that it is the foundation of human happiness and human creativity. Therefore, a very strong case is needed to justify curtailing it. I do not see that that strong case has been made out. I do accept that there will be deaths. I think that there will be deaths whatever we do, lockdown or no lockdown, and that the government's attempt to suppress the disease is simply unrealistic. I don't believe that they themselves consider that it can be suppressed. They have accepted ever since the papers that they published on the 13th of May that we were likely to have to live with COVID-19 long term. What we therefore need are steps for managing living with the disease, and not steps to suppress it entirely, which would be bound to fail. We need to learn to live with this disease, and we will need to learn to live with it even if there is a vaccine, because the consensus of immunologists at the moment is that this is not going to be a vaccine like measles or smallpox, which gives you a lifetime immunity. It's going to be a vaccine much more like the flu vaccine, which is not invariably successful. It doesn't work with everybody, and which gives immunity only for a limited period of time, and is also subject to being undermined by mutations in the flu virus. So this is not my own research. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm simply citing what appears to be the consensus most immunologists at the moment. I have yet to see a single one who thinks that this is going to be a magic bullet. Now, flu is not anything like as significant a killer as COVID-19, but it's still a significant killer. In a bad year, it can kill between 30 and 50,000 people over a winter in the United Kingdom. We have had to learn to live with flu, notwithstanding that there is a vaccine. We will have to do the same about COVID-19.
What about the argument that this lockdown could possibly suppress the transmission of the virus enough to protect the NHS until there is a vaccine?
Well, that returns to the a variant of the issue that we discussed a few minutes ago. I think that to try to suppress a disease until there is a vaccine is an extremely dangerous policy. We do not know how long it will take for there to be a vaccine. We do not know how long it will take to administer it to substantially the whole population. We do not know how many members of the population would be prepared to use the vaccine, but I think they would be sensible to do so. It seems to me that locking people down indefinitely is simply an inhumane, exceptionally damaging process. Moreover, it carries with it a spectacular injustice because the burden of these countermeasures is being borne by a sector of the population that is virtually invulnerable to the disease, namely the young and healthy. We are witnessing a situation in which bright engineering graduates and talented musicians are having to abandon their skills to stack shelves in supermarkets. The consequences of that will be with them for long after the rest of us have forgotten all about COVID-19. There is, moreover, I think, an incoherence at the heart of government policy making on this. We have known from the outset of this epidemic that it is selective. It's not like Spanish flu, which attacked people in their 20s and 30s, hitherto in good health. It attacks the old, over 70, and those with identifiable clinical vulnerabilities. We know what those vulnerabilities are. Apart from anything else, the government has itself defined them in Regulation 4 of its latest set of regulations. It seems to me quite extraordinary that the government is not willing to contemplate a selective system under which those who are actually vulnerable to becoming seriously ill are protected, and the rest of us, the rest of them, I'm over 70, can be allowed to earn their living and to live fulfilled lives. The idea that one should be locking down the entire population in order to save people who are vulnerable from having to take sensible precautions for their own safety seems to me to be truly extraordinary. We have had absolutely no explanation of this. We are told in an airy fashion, well, it's impractical. I fail to see why. I am not suggesting that there should be statutory applicable only to, for example, people over 70. What I am saying is that the public should be treated like adults. They should be allowed to take sensible precautions of their own devising, dependent on their own circumstances and those around them. That is a very much more efficient way of dealing with this than the way the government has so far set about it. We are spending hundreds of billions of pounds in compensating people who are unlikely to become seriously ill with COVID-19. That is a scandalous waste of money. We ought to be directing resources to those parts of the population, namely the vulnerable and the old, who actually need it.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, I agree with what you say, that it certainly seems like it wouldn't be impractical for older and more vulnerable people to shield themselves. But doesn't that just flip the generational impact away from young people and back onto older people? Is that necessarily fairer?
Yes, of course it is. But the older people are in a different position. They are vulnerable to becoming seriously ill or dying as a result of COVID-19, whereas the younger ones are not. You have to accept the fact that we have the disease with the characteristics it's got. It seems ridiculous to say, well, it's unfair if only people who are at risk are sheltered. We therefore have to shelter people who are not at risk. That seems to me to be transparently absurd.
I feel like you cannot really envision any scenario where you would support a lockdown.
No, that's not true. I can envisage such a scenario. If we were dealing with bubonic plague, to take an extreme example, with a mortality rate of 80%, of course it might be sensible to do that. If we were dealing with Spanish flu, which attacked people who were economically active in their 20s and 30s and hitherto healthy, and therefore not capable of being identified in advance as particularly vulnerable, I don't know whether I would accept that that was a sufficient occasion for doing this, but it would certainly be a stronger case than it is with COVID-19.
I think one of the key vulnerabilities that we have to this pandemic is the capacity of our health service, and particularly in Britain, with the regard in which the NHS is held. Do you not think that if there was a scenario where the NHS were to be completely overwhelmed and people were being turned away from hospital doors, that that would fundamentally undermine trust in the government, which in itself would damage our democracy, perhaps even more than the lockdown does?
Well, first of all, we've got to compare that with the deaths caused by the lockdown itself. The first lockdown caused large numbers of deaths, notably from cancer, because of the withdrawal of treatment for anything other than COVID-19. The government has, to some extent, learnt the lesson of that, and it's the way that it's dealt with the second lockdown. Dementia, which is the number one cause of death in the United Kingdom at the moment, and has been actually for some time, is a source of mortality, which is enormously aggravated by the lockdown measures. It seems to me you can't just look at deaths from COVID-19, which is way down the list of causes of death in the United Kingdom. Now, what is true, this may relate to the point that you make in your question, is that deaths with COVID-19 are more visible, more immediate, more dramatic. So if you are saying, well, politicians are liable to be criticized for deaths with COVID-19 when they wouldn't necessarily be for deaths with dementia, I would agree with you. But that is actually the main source of the problem. Politicians frequently find it difficult to distinguish between things that they will be criticized for not doing and things that are in the public interest. Their own interest is not to be criticized. Public interest is different. I agree that it sometimes takes courage to do the right thing, but I am not impressed by an argument that we should bless what politicians do because they lack the courage to do anything different.
Yeah, and one of the striking quotes from your Cambridge lecture was that in the long run, the principles on which we are governed matter more than the way we deal with any particular crisis. But I think what I'm trying to tease out is that the handling of this crisis could in itself undermine the principles on which we're governed. I think particularly people would be appalled if the NHS was allowed to fail.
I don't think that's very likely. I certainly think that it may undermine the reputation of successive governments who have, for example, failed to build up the NHS's intensive care capacity. I mean, it is a lamentable fact that we have one of the lowest intensive care capacities in Europe. Now, you're quite right to say that the National Health Service is held in high regard, but the fact is that the National Health Service has been underfunded for many years, that well-known sources of potential difficulty have been ignored. The danger of a major pandemic has been top of the National Risk Register since it was first published in 2008. One would have expected a build-up of the intensive care capacity of the NHS to deal with it, of a kind which has occurred in other countries, notably in Germany, but to some extent, Germany's done better than anyone else, but it's happened to a greater extent in other countries of Europe than it has in the United Kingdom. And that is a lamentable state of affairs. So you may be right in saying that governments would be discredited if people had to be turned away from hospital. That is not the same thing as saying that the whole democratic process is discredited.
And I think this brings us a bit more into the kind of wider context in which this is happening. I'd like to talk a bit about some of the points you touched on in your Reith lectures. I mean, back then in 2019, before the pandemic, you were warning, I think, about a sort of increasingly authoritarian style of government.
I was warning about the danger that this would arise from a combination of demands for security and fear. And I could not have expected that prediction to be so completely vindicated in such a short time.
Do you think it's the government's job to eliminate or mitigate all risk from our lives?
No, of course I don't. I think that in each case, you have to work out what the cost of doing so is. In general, the cost of mitigating risk is a reduction of liberty. And to those who believe that liberty is an important value, albeit not an absolute one, that is a very serious problem. In general, the way that risk is reduced is by preventing people from doing risky things, i.e. restricting the number of things which they are able to do. I cited a famous example of this from the case law in my Reith lectures. It was a case about a young man who threw himself headfirst into a very shallow pond at a famous beauty spot and was paralyzed for life. The Court of Appeal had held that the local authority should have prevented all people from visiting the site at all in case some of them threw themselves headfirst into the water and injured themselves in spite of the notices warning them of the danger. Now, when that case reached the House of Lords, the House of Lords said, well, you have to realize that the measures necessary to take to stop people doing this have the effect of preventing everybody else from visiting a beauty spot and behaving sensibly. This is the dilemma that we have every time that we have a risk assessment to carry out. The classic example, as I also pointed out in my Reith lectures, is motoring. We know that if we were to restore the Locomotive Act and limit the speed of cars in cities to 2 miles an hour, hundreds of lives would be saved. Why don't we do it? We don't do it because we would prefer to be allowed to travel around in comfort and speed.
I think when you made your Reith lectures back in 2019, we were sort of at the height of Brexit shenanigans. I wonder if you think that has played into the government's handling of this pandemic. You've said this government is characterised by a disregard for legal processes. I wonder if you think Brexit and everything preceding that enabled or somehow encouraged this particular government activism.
Yes, I do think that they are closely related because I think that in the course of, in particular, the last year of the political crisis over Brexit, which effectively ended with the general election of December 2019, the government acquired a contempt for, in particular, parliamentary institutions and for the courts, so far as the courts sought to defend the constitutional powers of parliamentary institutions. It preferred a model under which the government, so to speak, speaks directly to the people instead of having to go via parliament. The problem about that view is that the people have no institutional method of holding governments to account otherwise than via parliament, so that speaking directly to the people essentially means that you aren't accountable at all. Now, not being accountable at all is, of course, a welcome prospect for many politicians. But I don't see why the rest of us should admire that ambition.
Do you think the government's deliberately tried to avoid parliamentary scrutiny of its handling of the pandemic?
Well, I've no doubt about it. I mean, there have been a number of very striking illustrations of this, not to speak of the Speaker of the House of Commons' criticism that ministers are not making announcements in the House of Commons and are simply sidelining it. But the most remarkable demonstration of that was the circumstances in which the original lockdown was imposed. Because what happened, as you may recall, was that on the 23rd of March, the Prime Minister purported to give an immediate instruction that everyone was to lock down. This was said to be so urgent that Parliament couldn't be consulted in advance. Nevertheless, it took them 3 days until the 26th of March to produce their regulations. Now, why, if it was so urgent, did it take them 3 days to do it? The answer is perfectly simple. However urgent it was, they waited until Parliament was in recess on the 25th of March and published their regulations the next day. Now, that is only explicable as a desire to avoid any kind of debate in Parliament about the measures that were being adopted.
How do you think Britain's response compares to other democracies? Do you think there's something peculiar about us having an unwritten constitution that makes us vulnerable to a government who wishes to behave in this way and avoid parliamentary scrutiny in this way?
No, I don't. It seems to me that a written constitution would simply not help. Any written constitution, however elaborate, however formal, and however scrupulously enforced by the courts, depends for its workability on a shared set of political values. You can see how important a shared set of political values is when you look at a country like the United States, which has a written constitution and perhaps the most legal constitution in the world. Nonetheless, when you have a president who is determined to reject all the shared political culture that made it work for decades, you can see what happens. The thing just stopped working properly. There are any number of ways in which governments can subvert democracy if they are determined to do that. And the world is full of nominal democracies whose substance has been eviscerated by governments simply avoiding the restrictions which convention previously imposed. Now, Britain is particularly vulnerable to this process because so much of its constitution is dependent on convention. But I think it's a mistake to suggest that this is a peculiarity of countries without a written constitution. It is true of all countries.
As we're speaking, it looks like America might be turning its back on the era you just characterised. Do you think that there's a way forward for Britain? Do you think freedom will die, or can we claw it back?
I don't know. I think that there is what the pandemic has very clearly shown is that if you frighten people enough, they will submit even to the most intrusive and despotic arrangements. The government, having discovered this, is not going to forget it in a hurry. We have to bear in mind that even before the pandemic came along to demonstrate this wretched fact about most human societies, there was a disenchantment with democratic institutions, especially among the young. The successive annual surveys of political engagement published by the Hansard Society have been a very striking demonstration of this. The one that was published in April 2019, which I mentioned in my Reith lectures, suggests that a majority, I think the figure was 54% of the British population, would welcome government by a strong man. And most of those would say that this Putin-like figure should not be over-concerned with such political impedimenta as parliaments and courts. Now, to my mind, that is very dangerous. There is a widespread view that strong men are efficient, effective, and that despotism works. The people don't waste time engaging in tiresome and time-consuming discussions with quarrelsome parliamentarians and so on. This view is rubbish, even in its own terms. All experience historically suggests that if you have a system of government under which ultimately it is the authorities in the hands of a tiny number of people, you have a minimum of deliberation, a minimum of discussion, a minimum of internal self-criticism, and the result of this is not just despotic, it's very, very bad government. Even if you admire the measures that the government has taken, you could not possibly admire the way in which these decisions have been made. This government has given the impression, which I think is wholly justified, ever since March, of having no strategy, of lurching from pillar to post in response to the latest crisis, of endlessly trying to put out fires without any kind of long-term plan, of continual U-turns. This is not a sensible way to manage a pandemic, even if you happen to agree, unlike me, that locking people down is a good idea. What we are witnessing is many of the classic vices of authoritarian government.
Lord Thompson, I was hoping we could finish on a more positive note, but...
I find it hard at the moment to think of many positive notes, but if you can think of one, I shall be very glad to hear it.
Perhaps we could look forward to Christmas. Prime Minister has said, hopefully, that these measures will be time limited. What are your plans for Christmas?
I haven't got any yet. I will have to consult my family and the friends with whom we often celebrate Christmas.
Lord Sumption, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.